Hey everyone, welcome back to Deeper Than Dough. Today I'm talking with Jothy Rosenberg. This guy is a total powerhouse. He lost his leg, a lung, beat the odds, and built 9 startups. We get into resilience, what it takes to be an entrepreneur, and why proving people wrong is the best kind of motivation. Oh, and he's also changing kids' life through his nonprofit. This one is packed with inspiration and hard-earned wisdom. Before we jump in, don't forget to like, subscribe, and share with someone who needs to hear it. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Deeper Than Dough podcast. Today I have a special guest, Jothy Rosenberg. What a cool name. Welcome, Jothy. How's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for having me on. It's great to see you again, and great to see another guy wearing a flannel shirt in a cold climate.
We planned it, you know, matching outfits these days. I'll let you give your intro in a second, but I want to give you or give my little intro. We met on your podcast, which I'm sure we'll get into, but very, very unique. You shipped me a children's book that I got to read with my kids, and it was freaking awesome. And it's not just a children's book, but it's a children's book with all the nerdy, feel-good messaging that I absolutely love. And anyways, we love that.
Which age kid did you read it to?
3, 6, and 7.
They all like it?
Little too, he's distracted. The 7-year-old was actually reading it. So, yeah, they liked it a lot. It's really fun. You know, the giraffe and the animals. Anyways, so sorry for getting sidetracked, but what a cool thing. You're a children's book author along with so many other things. Can you give us a minute or two of your background?
Oh, sure. Well, I'm kind of been all over the place. I had a lot to deal with as a teenager, because before the age of 19, I lost a leg and a lung and had to figure out how to deal with that. Plus, my oncologist told me that when this cancer hits your leg and then spreads to your lung, no one had ever survived, which was a true statement, except mm-hmm. that chemotherapy had just come out. And so I was very fortunate. Everybody was telling me, you can't do this, you can't do that. And skiing was like absolutely, already by the age of 16, my favorite thing. And mm-hmm. And it was just brutal to me to hear all that. So when the chemo ended, I became a ski bum at Alta, Utah, right around the corner from you.
Yes.
And skied 100 days straight to try to figure out one-legged skiing.
One-legged. And I didn't remember the one lung either from our previous conversation.
I may not have mentioned it, but 3 years later it spread.
Okay.
And so, that motivates me to stay in very good shape. And so I swim and bike and all that stuff. And I wrote a book called Who Says I Can't? I think it's back there. Yeah. Who Says I Can't? Which is trying to give back to people or sort of pay it forward to somebody that's gotten a disability and is feeling really depressed, maybe despair, mm-hmm. and they need to understand how do they climb out of this hole, and not having self-esteem is dangerous, it's really, really bad. And so I wrote that, and then I tried to do a TV show with Who Says I Can't as the theme, and that's on YouTube now. And then I've got this startup career, and I'm currently still working on my 9th startup. And so in that process, I wrote a book called Tech Startup Toolkit. Oh, look, that happens to be right back here too. And that's trying to help startup founders where, 8 out of 10 startups fail. And I am hoping that with some help, I may be able to turn that around to, 8 out of 10 succeed. And then I did the podcast, which is a lot of fun. It's sort of a compliment to that. And I'm going to work on this online course. So together, those three things are really me doing my best effort to help startup founders as they come along.
Awesome. There's a lot to jump into there. First thing, just because I was reviewing a social media post that I'm posting on like a book review. Have you ever heard of a book called Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink? It's a Navy SEAL guy.
No.
Anyways, the principle of the book, like, here's my takeaway. I told somebody to do something, and you know, this is life or death situation, but in business, I told an employee to do something and they didn't do it, you know? And it's like, man, that employee, why didn't they do it? The extreme ownership note says, no, look at yourself. What could have you done better? So then it's like, okay, I told them to do it. Did I confirm that they understood? Did I put it in writing? Did I give them a due date? Did I tell them to reach out if they had questions? You know what I mean? But any situation, you put it back onto yourself and you're like, no, actually I could own this and trace it back to something I could or couldn't have done, you know, differently. I want to hear your thoughts on that, because like skiing with one leg for 100 days, that's, to me, that's extreme ownership. You know, who says I can't, but how does that, I guess just give me your thoughts on that principle.
Well, you're driven like a maniac to, like I said, dig out of this hole of feeling like, what can I do anymore? I mean, I was a very athletic kid, mm-hmm. and I like to do lots of things. I grew up in the Detroit area, so, you know, cold winters, and we skated. I rode my bike. I played touch football. I played backyard hockey. We just had so many things going on, and the family skied a lot. So all of those things seem to be, you know, gone. Mm-hmm. And so you're, the motivation to sort of build back, and what I would do is I learned to set very modest goals, because then I could achieve them and celebrate and then get the next one. And so for, you know, with skiing, it was like, okay, first time I tried it, I was on pointy poles, and that's not great. That doesn't work so well, but outriggers didn't exist yet. So yeah. then I got outriggers, and then I had to learn how to use them. And you're a skier, right? You know, that you don't, what we say in skiing is that you steer with your big toe. So that when you're on a slope, the downhill ski is the one that's going to give you the left turn. So that's your big toe. But for me, there is no, you know, when I'm turning left, it's my little toe that's digging into the hill. Uh-huh. And that meant that at first, when I was trying this, it would be turn to the right. And then when I would try to turn to the left, fall, turn, fall, turn, fall, because it just didn't work. It was just a matter of extreme focus and hard work. All the other ski bombs thought I was nuts. I was absolutely nuts, because I would go out no matter what the weather was.
I'm like, what is this guy? Especially like right at the beginning, right? If you like can't even get up, and you're like, what is this guy trying to do? Then fast forward. I mean, how long till you felt like you can ride down the whole? I mean, whatever metric we want to use, but like you could ride down comfortably down the entire.
Do you know the mountain there at all?
No, and I'm a snowboarder. I went skiing in fourth grade for a field trip one day. That's my limitation.
Oh, okay. So you're not even allowed to go to Alta with a snowboard.
I'm not even. Yeah, they're above
me. Well, there's a run there called Alf's High Rustler, because the guy that sort of founded the ski school there was a Norwegian Olympian called Alf Engen.
Okay.
And this is a run that's pretty spectacular. First of all, to get to it, you have to go this, you know, horrendous long, it's called the High Traverse. And then it's hard to get into the top of this run. And then you're looking, I mean, down at this incredibly steep angle at all the lodges. Uh-huh. And you think if you slip, you're going to roll all the way down there. And it's 2,000 vertical feet from there to the bottom. And so the goal was, I want to ski that uh-huh. by the end of the season. And I was there starting in December, and I had basically until like the middle of April. Uh-huh. And I had a little bit of help. I had somebody in the ski school decided that they thought this was cool. They wanted to learn about it themselves. They built a little thing on the back of their boot, of their left boot, so they could put just their foot with a snow boot on it, tucked right in there. So they were trying to simulate being they were a one-legged skier, but they had to get that other leg out of the way, and they got outriggers. And this guy was phenomenal, and he helped a lot. And it was just day after day after day. So, you know, first it was, okay, you know, what's it going to take to, you know, be able to just ski down the first run? And there, luckily there were a couple of blues there, and I started there. And then, you know, we just, but it didn't take long. I mean, honestly, within a month, I was starting to ski more and more. And then by the end of the season, I could ski fast, deep, snow, steep, you know, fine. Yeah. I was fine.
Well, how incredible is that, how quickly your body could become adapted to anything? I mean, I started jiu-jitsu 3 months ago, and then they also offer kickboxing. And it's like, there's so much that it's so hard at the beginning. And then once you catch the flow, for me, I would describe it as moving out of my mind into my body, right? Like out of the analytical, do I put my arm here first or here first versus just what feels better, right? And going with that feeling. One thing I wanted to bring up of what you said on like the goal setting up easy goals. I just listened to this recently. Neuroscientist Andrew Huberman, Huberman Lab podcast, talks about making a checklist of what you want to do, even if it's making coffee, something you're already going to do. Because if you put it down on like a to-do list and then you check it off, it raises the dopamine levels and it sets you up for the day. So it's like, I think the advice was find three things before noon that you can easily accomplish. Going to the gym, drinking coffee, having one meeting or whatever. Like, but I very much agree with that mentality of, you know, smaller goals, not becoming overwhelmed with this ginormous goal. But shifting gears here a little bit, 9 startups. I'm on the, you know, I guess I've done 2. I guess I'm on the 3rd. And
you might want to say how and why.
How and why? Yeah. That's my next one. I'm like, I already told myself after the second one, I'm like, I'm not doing a third one. And I'm like already starting a franchise brokerage. But I'm like, no, I'm going to keep it small. You know, we'll see if my mind changes. But yes, how and why, Jothi? 9 startups. That's crazy.
There, I talk about this in my book and on this, and I'm starting to do some of this course. And there is this thing about the startup itch. And I initially kind of got that itch when I was still a university professor, but I was working on a cool project for NASA. Okay. And it got far enough along that I thought, wow, this could really help people in the commercial world. It's too bad it's going to get locked up, you know, with NASA, but it didn't need to be. I didn't have any constraints. So I made this, you know, decision. I want to go try to make a startup out of this. And it took a lot of figuring things out, but I did it. And that wasn't a terribly successful outcome, but it was a learning experience. It was great. Because I saw the things that we could have done differently, I wanted to try again. And then I did. And that one turned out fantastically. And so now I'm hooked, right? The first one was, okay, you got to try another one because you can do better. Now that one was like, oh, that was fantastic. I wonder if I can do that again.
Okay, fantastic. Because I'm like trying to relate to this myself. Like, you know, the first one was like, okay, decent exit. Second one was a lot better exit, but way, way, way more stressful. So I'm like, was it better? You know, I grew a lot quicker and a lot bigger, but I'm like, was that the better way to go? So when you're like a lot more successful, did you experience that as well? I mean, obviously the high success, rapid growth, that's fun, but did you also experience the shit, am I going to go bankrupt tomorrow every single night and not sleep for a little bit?
Well, that one was not like that, but then subsequent ones have been, I mean, extremely difficult, I'm afraid. I'm not going to tell you what you want to hear, but I'm going to tell you the truth is that, I mean, this one. So after 8, you'd think, I must have this wired. Nope, this one has been the worst. Uh-huh. I mean, it was just so hard, and it was so hard without the pandemic, and then the pandemic made it much harder. And, you know, I've had to loan it money. I've had to get PPP money. I've come so close to missing payroll, and I've had cold sweats at night, and it's just, yeah, it's been.
I mean, really hard. Through it nine times. So it sounds like not all nine gave you that, but you know, probably most of them did. So what do you say to an entrepreneur in that situation? In like the deep, the depths of like, I need this business to survive. If it doesn't survive, I'm going to go bankrupt and then everybody's going to hate me because I'm attached to, you know, that identity of being a business owner or being successful and other people.
There's an easy answer to this, Bennett. So a couple answers. First of all, even this one that has been so hard, I look back on it and I still say this was a joyful thing to do because unlike, you know, I've also worked at big companies, we can make decisions on a dime. We can pivot. We can make changes in the product. You're at a big company and you want to make change in the product. I mean,
I'm experiencing that. I sold my company to a much larger company and I'm like,
you got to go through so many layers.
Yep.
Well, see, but you know, big companies are extremely risk averse. And you know, you don't make a change to the Apple, iPhone without being extremely careful that, you know, nothing can go wrong. And whereas at a startup, it's like, okay, well, something went wrong, we'll fix it. I mean, that's what's still joyful about it. And I wouldn't trade it for going back to working at a big company. Mm-hmm. I did that, and I don't want to do that again. So that's the biggest part of it.
Okay. Well, what is this ninth startup? I mean, because we've talked, you're doing books, okay, podcasts, online courses, nonprofit. What is this ninth startup that has given you more challenges?
Well, it's in cybersecurity, and I did two others that were cybersecurity. They were software. This one, let me just explain why I did one that's not a software one. The problem I was trying to solve is that the really bad guys, like the nation states and the very sophisticated attackers, are leveraging the fact that there are bugs in software and they can come in over the network. They're good at finding the bugs, and then they'll exploit them by overwriting when you've got a website that's got a place for your name, uh-huh, and it turns out they forgot to check if your name fits, and then the bad guys figure out, oh, well, that means I don't have to just have that be a name. I can write instructions for that computer in those spaces for millions of characters, and now they've written an entire program that they use to take over your computer. And I wanted to, I knew that the only way to stop that is with hardware.
I just ran into this. Literally, my yoga instructor told me this over Christmas break that happened, that they took control of her computer and she saw him like going into Citi and just started like Citibank, Chase Bank, Wells Fargo. And she's like, I flipped out. I unplugged everything. Like that was going to do anything. But anyways, yeah, that blew my mind. I'm like, anyways, keep going on the cybersecurity, but yeah, the need out is definitely out there.
Well, so decision was it has to be hardware because they can't come over the network and rewire your silicon chip. Mm-hmm. But for a startup company to get into the business of developing hardware, and then we're not going to make the chip that's going to go in this, you know, in this computer, that's not our business. But what we have to do is then license our IP to the chip companies, and then they put it in their chip and they sell their chip to the device companies, whatever it is, whether it's something in a car or a jet or a lawnmower, you know, whatever. Yeah. And so that's really hard. That's a really hard sale to make. And B, it takes a really long time from the moment you've closed a deal with a chip company. Now they have to build it into that chip. That takes maybe a year. Then they have to sell it to the device manufacturers. And then how long does that take for them? Anyway, 2 years is a really long time to wait for revenue. Yeah. And that's been our fundamental problem. So I'm trying to sell it to somebody that has more resources to put behind it and can deal with, it'll take 2 years. But once it starts to sell, we were going to get a per chip royalty. Now, we were only going to get 6 cents a chip, but the companies that we're talking to sell 100 million chips a year.
Yeah, times
six. That's the law of big numbers. Yep. Those are big numbers.
Yep.
So you definitely need that's the challenge.
You need the backing of your. There's just so much to do in a startup, especially when you have the big vision. You're like, I'm going to do everything, but it takes so much time, resources. And luckily, there are companies that do that. That you know, grab the startups and take them to that next level. So, anyways, super cool. And aside from that, you have several books, both you know, for the general population and for children, a podcast, an online course, and there's also a nonprofit. What is the goal? I guess if we kind of take a step back and say, you know, what are you after? What is the definition of success? And why are you pursuing all of these different avenues?
Well, I am heading towards retirement. I'm going to sell this company, like I said, and I'm kind of lining up the things I want to do in retirement. And there are two, and they're just two buckets. One, help startup founders. That's three things: the book, the podcast, the online course. That's a lot of work, but it's fun work. The other is this nonprofit, and that's helping kids who've become disabled get the adaptive equipment they need to get into a sport they love, which will rebuild their self-esteem. Those are my two things.
Okay, I love that. Let's go on the first one. What is the name of your podcast and course to share with everyone? And is the course finished, or is that something that it's in development stage?
So the podcast is called Designing Successful Startups. We finished our first year. This is our second year. One a week, startup founder is the guest. The startup people I talked to were fantastic. You were one of them. The online course is not yet done. It will take me a couple more months, and it's going to be called Who Says You Can't Start Up?
It's
going to have 53 lessons in it. All of them are relatively short, 15-minute videos with some written materials that people can get as well off the site. It's not free. Podcasts are obviously free, but this one's not. But I think people are going to like it who are thinking about a startup or doing one already and kind of need some additional resources, help, whatever.
Yeah, I had a solar company, had a decent exit, and then I took a startup ignition course. It was called Startup Ignition. Startup course, 3 days. I had to fly, travel, get all of that. And I'm like, why would I do this if I just sold a business, right? But a buddy's like, no, you don't know what you're doing. Like, just come see this guy, take his course. I did it, and I realized I didn't know anything. I just got lucky on timing and partnerships and everything. And I learned what a startup actually was, because I, you know, didn't have an education behind it, and it completely changed. If you look at the trajectory of, you know, solar versus dirty dough was a lot quicker, even though solar was still a decent speed. And I 1,000% attribute it to going to somebody like you that's been doing this for a lot longer than I have, and getting those key points of advice, such as like vesting and how to do partnerships. But can you share with us, what are a few of the key points that founders are missing that they'll learn through your course or through the podcast?
So I think the biggest thing of all is what is called product market fit. And I don't think any startup can succeed that hasn't proven product market fit. That is, that there's a market, and it's got to be a big market. And a growing market, and that your product has proven to be something that solves a big problem for the people in that market, and they'll pay money for it. And it sounds straightforward, but it's really not. It's really hard, and it's a barrier. It's a barrier to if you're going to try to raise money from outside, you won't be able to until you've, you know, achieved that
concept. Yeah. I love building out sales processes on like, what's your product, you know, identifying that. And because I've had a little bit more free time, I've done this with, I don't know, 3 dozen people in the last handful of months, just for free, for fun at the gym, whatever, you know, like, what is that sales process and I guess cycle. So what I've been telling them, and what I think works really good, I'll give an example, like a guy works for Google Fiber. Hey, how do I contact businesses? I just got promoted to do B2B over Utah. How do we go do that? I was calling business owners that I knew, and it's just like, hey, this is the kind of doing interviews. What I was trying to identify is the top three reasons people would buy my product and the top three reasons people wouldn't buy my product. And it was just like a, hey, can you answer, you know, take a 5-10 minute phone call. And people are way willing to do that. So for Google Fiber, it was speed, reliability, and price. Like, we're cheaper, we're faster, and we're more reliable. And I'm like, for a small business owner, it's all about price, right? If they could save $100 a month, that's what it is. Well, after three interviews, all three of them said, no, it's reliability. And then we were able to completely, you know, adjust that pitch. So that's more on the sales side, but how can we relate that to product market fit, I guess? What are those things that we need to be doing to prove the product market fit? I just gave an example of, you know, interviews, and that's very preliminary. Anything else you would add on to that?
Well, you know, when the best thing is to try to, and this is for B2B kind of stuff, right? I mean, so it's to find a lighthouse customer. That's a sort of a jargony term for someone who's willing to be out in front of anybody else. Perhaps maybe they're feeling the problem more severely than anyone else in their market, and they're willing to work with you and help you define sort of the first step towards product market fit, which is a minimum viable product. What is the product with just the set of features that would make somebody say, yes, this solves my problem and I will pay money for it. And you don't want to build something more than that because you don't know the market yet well enough to already be defining, you know, the additional features. So lighthouse customer, which you got to do by canvassing, you know, wherever you think you're going to find people, just like you talked about doing. And then, you know, interview them about, I think I've got something that can solve this problem. Is this a really big problem for you? And would you work with us to help us define the right product for that? Test that with a few other people. And now you've got a sense that you're going to get, you know, more than one person, customer, to sign on.
Yeah, lighthouse customer. I haven't heard that term, but that is, it's like, here's the way, you know, we did it. Another thing that I always recommend in finding your product fit or that lighthouse customer, right? It's, hey, this is kind of what I'm doing. I'm trying to solve this goal. You know, I'm headed in the right direction. I don't know yet though. I could build this and help you and build it around you. And then you're offering either a discount or extras or whatever, you know, coaching calls in addition to whatever you're doing, but some extra in exchange for video testimonial and feedback. That's what I always do. And then I push out those video testimonials because I think in anything that I've sold, it's much better to listen to an existing customer talk about why they like the product rather than the salesperson, right? Or the owner of the company.
Oh, absolutely.
But even if you do all this, business is still super, super hard. So jumping into like to the mental health side, in those deep moments, the perilous moments, let's call them, how do you get through those? If we could jump into a little bit more, I guess, actionable items on, you're here, do X, Y, Z to, you know, alleviate yourself from that stress, anxiety, overwhelming feeling.
Well, one thing I try to compartmentalize and not, and I try, it's not always easy, but I try not to bring all that stress back to home, back to family. And that compartmentalization, if you can do it, it takes some practice. It helps enormously. I also consider exercise a very high priority that I put on the calendar. So, and things that are on the calendar don't get overwritten. right? So you know, I swim 3 times a week, and I kept doing that even in the darkest times. And there's, you know, whatever sport you love, it can be very cathartic to just go do it. You don't have to kill yourself doing it. You can just go have a relaxed workout, but you're doing that. You tend to not think about the things that are sort of haunting you. They're back here somewhere. Certainly while I'm swimming, I'm not thinking about those things because I got to think about the wall that I'm coming up to. I've got to think about, you know, breathing. I also count laps. And so just that counting is also occupying, you know, your brain. So to me, those kinds of things, compartmentalization, and then now, you know, in terms of how do I deal with it at, you know, in terms of when I'm in the moment at the job, it's always dependent on what is the crisis.
Well, I do think that your answer though is the more applicable answer. You know, it's like, okay, well, most people can get through the day at work. It's the after work stressing and the after, you know, trying to sleep with your mind racing. So I hear, I'm going to interpret your, I compartmentalize, or I said that wrong, but whatever. You're present, right? Because if you're not keeping things, here's my work compartment, here's my home compartment, and you're crossing them over. So I'm thinking about work at home. That's the definition of not being present, right? So I think that, and I'm like, maybe that's just because I'm reading those types of books, you know, presence and like being in the moment. And then you talk about movement, and I'm like, okay, there's two things that occupy a lot, most of our consciousness, or all of it: our sensations from our body and our thoughts, right? So mind and body. And to get out of the mind, you get into the body. So how do I, if I don't want all of these crazy word vomit thoughts of stress going in, I need to then shift my consciousness or my focus to my body. And you mentioned those areas. Like if you jump into a cold bath, you are not thinking about if you're paying the bills tomorrow, right? If you're swimming and you're counting laps, it's the same thing. So love everything that you said. I'm just, I guess, reframing it in like being present, getting out of the mind into the body. Would you agree with my interpretations of?
Yeah, it sounds like a perfect mapping. Yes.
Okay. Awesome. With the last few minutes, I'd love to get into the nonprofit. You mentioned a little bit about it before, but I'd like to hear more about it. How can we help support it? Have you launched it yet? Is it official? What's the process like?
I formed it in February of 2014. It's been up and running for a while. But it's a small family run. It's my wife and me, my daughter, my son-in-law, and we run it. And so we can't help that many kids a year, but you know, I've learned to be very appreciative of
every year. Right?
Well, we help one or two per year.
That's freaking awesome.
And those kids are able to articulate that this changed their lives. I mean, I'll give you one example. Just please. Young Emma was, when we first met her, she was 10, and she was born with a birth defect that meant she had no tibia. And without a tibia, your knee doesn't function either. So to clean that up, they had to give her an amputation above her knee. Now, she got a prosthesis and she learned to use it. She didn't like it that much, but she had to use it at school. But at home, she'd take it off and she became a hopper around the house. And all that was all fine until she got to fourth grade. And then she was being left out of things in gym class. And that started to make her sad. For the first time in her life, she was honestly kind of depressed, which is when we found out about her, because she didn't know. She didn't know that running was even possible, and her parents were not well off. These running legs, even for a young girl like Emma, cost us $21,000. They're very expensive. But when we had that made for her and when it was delivered to her, she was normally supposed to put it on and then get in the parallel bars and practice in a safe way. She said, "No way." Now, this is a girl that's never in her life had the sensation of running. So how she knew what to do, I'll never know. But she put it on and she ran across the room. And then she's been running ever since. She likes this leg. She never used to like the other leg. And she's a hero in gym class. They're all excited about her. And she says this transformed her life. And she articulates that beautifully. And we've helped about, I don't know, 15, 16 kids since we started this way.
That's so incredible.
Some have birth defects.
That is so... I was just didn't want you to discount that. We help, you know, there's kids we can't help. Yes, of course. But like 16 people, you're not giving them a meal, you know, that would be great. You are changing their life. And especially from my point of view, like it's coming from you. Like, hey, here's the path. I've done 9 startups. You know, I'm helping others. I think that not only is giving them the opportunity, but also the confidence and like, I could go do whatever the hell I want with my life. So congratulations on that. Is there any way listeners can support it?
So it's called Who Says I Can't, and it's at Who Says I Can't, all one word, no apostrophe or anything, .org. And there's a donate button. There's a way to join the newsletter, which also, and people could reach out to me directly. I'm Jothy, Jothy, at whosaysicant.org. And they could say, you know, that they would like to volunteer. They'd like to help whatever. That would be great.
I love that. Okay. Other than the email, anything else as far as like how listeners can connect with you?
So the podcast is, as we mentioned, Designing Successful Startups, and my general email address, if people want to just reach out to me, is jothy@jothyrosenberg.com.
Okay, well, we'll throw all of those in the show notes. Jothy, I really appreciate your time and sharing your experience with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been fun.